So we're going to begin with the letter to Titus, which seems to me to be the earliest of the three pastoral letters. There's unanimous agreement that this letter, Titus, and the two letters to Timothy form a special subgroup of the Pauline letters. Like the letter to Philemon, they are addressed to individuals, to Titus and Timothy, two of Paul's collaborators. All Paul's other letters are addressed to communities. However, not too much should be made of this, for there are indications in the letters that they are meant to be read by the communities. They purport to be letters of advice and instruction sent to Titus and Timothy in their role as church leaders. Paul is just as interested in the communities knowing that he expects them to accept the leadership of Titus and Timothy as guaranteed by Paul's own authority. In other words, they're a letter to Titus that he wants Titus's community to be listening to and reading so that they will expect Titus to behave in this way with Paul's authority. So they're not a personal letter. Because of their pastoral nature, these three letters are commonly referred to as the pastoral epistles. The author introduces himself as Paul. And there's no evidence from the early church, or indeed for the first 1800 years of the church's life, of any dispute about the identity of the author. However, modern critical scholarship has brought us to the situation today in which the majority of scholars, but not all, either argue or assume that someone other than Paul composed these letters in his name. Earlier in our study, we looked at this whole question of pseudepigraphy, and we saw that there's nothing inherently problematic about this suggestion, provided that it's understood that this was the way which a faithful disciple of Paul chose to convey what he understood to be Paul's authentic thoughts about church organization and government, and about what was important in the life of the communities of Crete and Asia to whom these letters were addressed. I'll pick up the image that I used that may have helped you on that earlier occasion. I remember saying, for example, talked about Ignatius of Loyola, the founder of the Jesuits, and suggesting that I, for example, whoever's out in front, may be the general of the Jesuit order today, and I might in prayer discern what Ignatius would want of the Jesuits in the 21st century. And I might write a letter, I, Ignatius, and then go on. And you know I'm writing it, you know it's not Ignatius writing it, but you know, and I'm writing I, Ignatius, to say that I'm not interested in my own ideas. I'm interested in presenting to you in an updated fashion what Ignatius's real thought is. And you, my fellow Jesuits, will make your own judgment on that. You might say you're completely wrong. But if you copy it, treasure it, hand it on, you're saying to this disciple has got Paul's thought right. This is what Paul would want because we know Paul. Do you follow my logic? Therefore, in itself, it's not an inherently problematic thing. I also went on to show you on that earlier occasion that the Bible is absolutely full of such writing. Moses wrote the Torah, did he? Moses may not have written anything, but the Torah comes from the spiritual experience of Moses. David wrote the Psalms, did he? Presumably, yes, he did write some Psalms, but all the Psalms are then basically, not all of them, but are put under David. Solomon wrote the Book of Wisdom, did he? Of course he didn't. It was 900 years after Solomon, 700 years after Solomon. But all the wisdom literature, do you see what's happening? They're These are the big figures under whose authority, no, under whose inspiration these books are written. So that's quite possible in the New Testament. So those who argue that a disciple of Paul faithfully gave Paul's thoughts to a later generation is not in itself inherently a problem. It's a question of finding out, is it true? In keeping with the practice of the times, it's possible that a disciple of Paul wrote in Paul's name in order to remind people that the martyred Paul was still present among them, inspiring them by his teaching and active in the life of the church. At the same time, after 200 years of scholarly debate, some scholars continue to argue that Paul is, in fact, the author. So this encourages us to explore the question, could Paul have composed the pastoral epistles? So that's our question. Our first question is this. Could what is written in these letters fit the situation of Crete and Ephesus in the 60s? The response to that question, firstly, nothing in what is written required a situation significantly different in time from the period just before Paul's death. Secondly, a number of considerations favour this time rather than late in the century. The stress placed on the authority of Paul's representatives indicates a less developed stage of local leadership than we find, for example, in the letters of Ignatius of Antioch, composed in the first years of the second century. More significantly, the pastoral letters envisage a situation in which there is still an expectation of growth and development in Jewish Christian communities. This was not the case in the latter decades of the first century. Furthermore, the various problematic situations mentioned in these letters can be paralleled from Paul's other correspondence. So in response to the first question, we can say that the content of the letters could have been written in the mid-60s. In other words, by Paul. And could have been written to Crete and Ephesus as the letters themselves claim, if it can be established by other criteria that someone else composed these letters, the above considerations point to his writing soon after Paul's death. So still focusing on the content, we ask a second question now. Could what is said have been said by Paul? We've shown that it could have been said in the early 60s. Could it have been said by Paul? Or does it reveal an author with different ideas, different values, different concerns? The fact that these letters were accepted for so long as written by Paul is itself an indication that they do not only do not contradict Paul's thought, but that they have been read as being consistent with it. For God's sake, 1800 years of scholars read it, said it was Paul, and never had a problem with it. They're not all dills. So it'd be most surprising if it had thoughts that contradicted Paul or were so unrecognizable. As already noted, they form a special subgroup among the Pauline letters. They have a special and limited focus and aim. They are unique among his letters in that they are written to church leaders precisely in their role as pastors. They contain advice and instruction about the responsibility of Paul's representatives in their guiding of the communities in living a Christian life. Ministry and ethics are central to these letters. This unique focus is adequate explanation for the special content and vocabulary. Some find it strange that Paul would write to intimate co-workers in such a relatively impersonal and formal way. We should note, however, that the author is not dropping them a friendly line. He clearly intends the letters to be read, could we say overheard, by the congregations. The letters function more as a guarantee that Paul stands behind the authority of the leaders. They are written to support Titus and Timothy and as instruction for those for whom they're exercising care. To pick up my earlier image, Ignatius of Loyola writes differently when he's sending a personal letter of encouragement to a fellow Jesuit and when he's writing a rule of life to be followed. We might assume that most of what Paul writes in these letters was already known by Titus and Timothy after years working closely with Paul. He might sound as though he's instructing them, but he's rather instructing the communities to expect this kind of instruction and leadership from them. In his excellent introduction to the Anchor Bible commentary on Titus, written in 1990, Jerome Quinn writes, sadly, Jerome Quinn died not long after. I wish he'd managed to write commentaries on all of the pastoral letters. But he has this in a quite a brilliant introduction to Titus. He says, they, that is Titus and Timothy, are models of Paul and models for believers as they are designated to carry on the apostle's work, carry out his commands, imitate his sufferings, teach his gospel, and practice it themselves, preside at the liturgy, receive material support for their ministerial work, and choose other men who in their turn will share their apostolic ministry. This brings us to a further question. If the content of the pastoral epistles could have been written by Paul, what about the style? Now we're right into the key argument. Style is a big, who said it? Le style est l'homme. Some famous French author said that anyhow. The style is the man. So let's look at the style. Maybe that'll be the giveaway. Could Paul have written in this way? As already noted, the special vocabulary is not a problem. It's adequately explained by the focus and unique content of the letters. We hope to show in the commentary that Paul's use of certain technical words that are not in his usual vocabulary can be adequately explained without having recourse to the hypothesis of another author. Authors note the lack of many of the connecting particles that we're accustomed to find in Paul's writing. You know, prepositions, or rather conjunctions, you know, because, wherefore, all these little manners of speech that connect a phrase to another phrase, tiny particles. Now, we miss a lot of those here, and authors note that. However, this too can be sufficiently explained by the focus of the letters. In the other letters which are written to communities, Paul is often arguing certain points. And if you're involved in an argument, your becauses and your wherefores and your sinces and your other things are coming in because you're developing an argument. But this is not the case in these letters. In a sense, they're much simpler. They're just statements. He feels no need to persuade Titus or Timothy. So all the kind of words that one would introduce into one's speech when you're trying to persuade a recalcitrant community in Corinth or a troublesome group that are being attacked in Galatia, you know, or a Roman community that you want to convince are on, that your gospel is not what they're hearing from someone else. All that kind of rhetoric is not in these letters. There's no need for it. So the particles that introduce such argument can be absent for that reason too. Titus and Timothy know why he's insisting on certain things. His purpose is rather to state what is to be done in acting decisively to strengthen their communities against divisive ideas that are undermining the gospel. There's no need for the many particles that would have been needed in the cut and thrust of argument. This also helps explain the relative lack of the kinds of spontaneous and energetic outbursts that we associate with Paul. You can see what I'm doing here is I'm picking up the kinds of arguments that I've found in scholarly circles. Most writers, by the way, don't talk about any of this. They just say Titus and Timothy were written by a disciple of Paul, and they go on. They don't look at it, argue it, they just say it because other people are saying it. Having gone back to the people who say it and argue it, you can probably see what I'm doing. I'm picking at their arguments and finding them lacking in substance. Now, are they right? Am I right? I'm not going to say I'm right. I'm just telling you what I've done. And I'm here, so that's what you're getting. This helps explain the relative lack of the kinds of spontaneous and energetic outbursts that we associate with Paul. He's not writing to communities about their problems or questions or about his personal relationship with them, nor is he writing a friendly letter to a co-worker. He's laying down policy concerning government to ensure a continuation of the kind of authority that is needed when he himself is no longer around. I think that's the key. Paul, even in the letter to the Philippians, which we've just read, said he's hoping to come to see them soon. Okay, Paul is in a position where his life is about to close. It's ebbing away. He's a grandmother, and the kids are growing up, and she's got emphysema, and she just wants to say something to her children and their children that they won't forget because she won't be around to say it anymore. That's a big difference. You do things differently. So Paul knows he's not for this world, so he's laying stuff down that he normally would talk about and presume and be there to be advised, all of that. That's if Paul wrote it. I haven't finished the argument yet, but one would expect a certain impersonality, a certain formality, a certain lack of spontaneity as he expresses principles to which he's given much thought. It's unusual for Paul to put so much stress on tradition rather than on his own divine commission. But can you see from what I've already said? His own divine commission has come to an end. They have to rely on something else. They have to remember now, not just be open in faith to Paul's colossal charismatic power. They have to remember what he said to them and remember what they've done in the churches and remember what Titus have learned from him. So it's tradition that comes in necessarily, I would suggest, in such letters, and rightly. Perhaps knowing that he will not be with them much longer for reasons of age, health or danger, all of which were present, he purposely stresses tradition which will still be there when he's gone and which is not dependent on his personal presence. Some of those who judge that these letters are the work of a disciple, some of them suggest that the author may have drawn on material actually written by Paul. This is especially likely for Titus and 2 Timothy. In fact, if there was no argument, if there wasn't a general hypothesis to the contrary, nobody would doubt that 2 Timothy was written by Paul. 2 Timothy is just a straight... But there's 1 Timothy, we'll see reasons as we study through. So they suggest that what's happened is that Paul actually did write letters to them, and now they've been, you know, updated, as it were, and reapplied in a later generation. Timothy and Titus may even have been party to the composing of the letters. They may have received letters from Paul, real letters, and then themselves, 10 years later, have written a pastoral letter incorporating Paul's letters but generalising for a later community. That's not impossible. If this is what happened, the aim was to express Paul's teaching in such a way as to retain the feel of his continual presence among them, guiding and caring for them, hence the personal bits that come in. Jerome Quinn, whom I've already quoted, favours the idea that the pastoral letters were composed after Paul's death, and I respect his scholarship quite enormously in this matter. He sees Crete and the letter to Titus as being typical of a small Jewish Christian house churches, while Ephesus and 1 Timothy are typical of larger and predominantly Gentile house churches. In other words, Paul's written, they've composed documents that would really be useful in a Jewish Christian community, say 10 years later, and really useful for a Gentile community as general pastoral guidance to the leaders. So that's Jerome Quinn. The following is I. Howard Marshall's conclusion to his lengthy and balanced treatment of this subject in the 1999 International Critical Commentary. And they're a good series, the International Critical Commentaries. And Jerome Quinn is a Catholic scholar. Howard Marshall, I'm not sure, but I know he's not Catholic. He's Anglican or Methodist, I'm not sure. If I did know, but I've forgotten. And he concludes this way. He says, our hypothesis is that the indications are that the pastoral letters belong to the period shortly after the death of Paul. They, especially 2 Timothy, are based on authentic Pauline materials whose extent cannot now be traced precisely, and they may well have been produced in a group which included Timothy and Titus themselves. The stimulus came from the existence of an authentic letter behind 2 Timothy, which was already beginning to face up to the problems of the opposition and led to the composition of 1 Timothy and Titus to deal more explicitly and fully with the problems caused by the opposition and heresy in Ephesus and Crete. The letters were intended to give Pauline backing to Timothy and Titus and associated church leaders in their work of calling the congregations back from false teaching and practices. Their composition was in no sense deceptive in that it was known that these were fresh formulations of Pauline teaching to take account of the changing situation. Nevertheless, with the passage of time, the origins of the letters were forgotten and they were assumed to be from Paul himself. If Quinn, this is my comment now, if Quinn and Marshall and many other scholars are correct in assigning the letters to a disciple rather than to Paul, we mustn't forget that it was the author's intention that those reading the letters would do so as though they were listening to Paul himself. The intention was to reproduce what Paul himself would have said were he still alive. We should remember that this is how these letters were read and why they were preserved, treasured, copied and distributed. This is how they've been read down through the centuries. We would be wrong to so highlight their pseudonymity. If you're not familiar with the word, it means the name under which it's written is pseudo, false. We would be wrong to so highlight their pseudonymity as to fall into the temptation of thinking that their value is thereby lessened. We too would do well to focus on the content and to listen to Paul as we read, for we hear in these letters a number of Paul's concerns. We hear his concern that Christians in the various communities, Jewish and Gentile, remain in communion by being faithful to the tradition which they've received. We hear his concern that they remain in communion with other Christians by their love and by maintaining unity in the church. We hear his concern that they remain in communion as they hold firm to the gospel in the hope of sharing Jesus' eternal communion with God in the glory that awaits them. Perhaps the strongest call that we hear ringing out of these letters is Paul's concern that Christians continue the mission of proclaiming the gospel to the world. For Paul is passionately convinced that God wills every person to be saved and to come to the knowledge of the truth. It's for this reason that he seeks to support the authority of the leaders against false teaching that could undermine his mission. Finally, now I've come to the end of this long, my introduction, since the onus is on those who deny Pauline authorship to establish their case, and since, in my opinion, they have not done so, though, of course, I've given you some fine authors who are of that persuasion, but they don't say it certain, I will be commenting on the pastoral epistles on the assumption that they were composed by Paul himself. Personally, I have no trouble hearing Paul in these writings. It's an older Paul. He may be about 70 years old at the time of writing. It's a Paul who is very concerned that erroneous teaching, if not checked, could wreck the church. It's also a Paul who loves Christ and in whose heart the fires of a missionary still burn strongly. Some suggest ways in which these letters can be fitted in to what we know of Paul's life from the Acts of the Apostles. It seems more likely that they belong to a period between Paul's release from the Roman prison in 62 AD and his martyrdom there, traditionally dated in 67. It would seem best to place his letter to Titus and his first letter to Timothy during his sojourn in the East, perhaps in 65. Eusebius, that's the historian, the first great historian of the church, writing in the very early years of the 4th century, 300, you could say. Eusebius tells us that his second letter to Timothy was composed during his second imprisonment in Rome, just prior to his martyrdom. So we're working on the assumption that Paul was indeed released from detention in Rome and that he returned to his mission fields in the East. Though we have no conclusive proof that he was released, it's not at all unlikely. 2 years was the maximum time in which a person could be held awaiting conviction. We know that Festus, the Roman procurator in Palestine, recognized Paul's innocence and sent him to Rome only because Paul had insisted on his right to go there. Presumably, the covering letter sent by Festus would have conveyed his opinion to the Roman authorities. If the accusers failed to pursue the matter, Paul would have been released after the statutory 2 years. When Paul wrote his letter to the Romans in Corinth in the early months of 57 AD, he was thinking that his time in the East had come to an end. He kept experiencing in prayer a call to go to Rome, and he was already planning to go west to Spain. We find all that in Romans chapter 15. However, we need to remember that since those plans were formed, Paul has spent 2 years in custody in Caesarea and a further two in Rome. In his letter to the Philippians, written from Rome, prison, it's clear that he's now planning to return to the East, because he says to the Philippians how he hopes to see them soon. We assume that he did so. In other words, he's changed his mind about going west, and that he composed Titus and Timothy, 1 Timothy, while in the East, that he was recaptured, imprisoned in Rome, and composed 2 Timothy in Rome before his execution in 67 AD.